Genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brains.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turn now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Hi, this is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're live every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. You can also hear us streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura County. If all of this sounds like National Public Radio, well, you're getting the idea. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is NPR done right. If you want to join in the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008. Or if you're outside of the area code, it's area code 805-639-0008. Every show has a theme, and today's theme in the second hour is shame, blame, and near fame. Each of my guests will discuss one of these topics. My first guest explores the final frontier, women as astronauts. She examined the careers of 13 women who dared to show the right stuff in NASA's space program, but who were washed out because of the times. We'll talk about the near-fame experience of these women from her book titled Almost Astronauts. My second guest has examined overcoming a toxic emotion, that is shame. She describes an emotion that is born out of a cultural attitude and defines some groups of people less than other groups of people. We'll discuss bringing shame out of the closet. My third guest will answer the question, who do you blame when things go wrong? We'll discuss how the hidden rules of credit and blame determine our success or our failure from his book, The Blame Game. And if you want to join in the conversation or talk to any of my guests, you can call us at 639-0008. Tanya Lee Stone studied English at Oberlin College and was the editor of children's nonfiction for many, many years. She also has a master's degree. After many years as an editor, Tanya moved to rural Vermont and returned to writing. This award-winning author has written titles that are young adult favorites, including A Bad Boy Can Be Good for a Girl, Up Close with Ella Fitzgerald, Elizabeth Leads the Way, Sandy Circus, and the book that we'll talk about, Almost Astronauts, 13 Women Who Dared to Dream. Welcome to the show, Tanya. How are you today?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being my guest, and thank you for writing about this nearly forgotten piece of American history. And a lot of people don't know the story, so let's recap it for them. Almost Astronauts tells the story of some very brave women in the 1960s who fought to become astronauts when only men were allowed into the space program, in the NASA program. So set the stage for us. What limits were placed on women during the 1950s and 1960s that really prohibited them from becoming astronauts?
Sure. Well, as you know, there were lots of limitations on women at that time. Women couldn't do many things like play on professional sports teams, rent a car without a co-signature from a father or a husband, ditto taking a loan out from a bank, etc. There were only certain types of jobs that were really open to women at the time. And there were women in the aviation field. But the catch in this whole big story to remember is that the criteria for astronauts at the time, which was the very beginning of our space program, there had only been one group of astronauts who came before the time these women were tested, and that's the Mercury 7 men, your John Glenn and Scott Carpenter, that crew. The criteria for astronauts that NASA had come up with was that astronauts should be culled from jet test pilots, which was a perfectly reasonable criteria to have, fearless, brave, physically fit, smart, except that the catch was that women weren't allowed to be jet test pilots. So that's sort of where we were when Randy Lovelace, who was one of the scientists who had put the Mercury 7 guys through their paces, thought to himself, what if women were equally qualified to be astronaut candidates as men? They weigh less, they take up less space, they use less oxygen, they eat less food. So he basically thought, wow, if I'm right, pound for pound, I'll save NASA millions of dollars. So he sort of set out to gather up the cream of the crop women pilots in the country and put them through the same testing that the Mercury 7 men had been through to see if his theory was correct, and kind of laid low about the whole thing because he knew what the societal prejudices were towards women.
All right. And it's very interesting because Randall Lovelace, who is sort of, if you will, the unsung hero of your book, really understood the financial implications of this. You mentioned that it might save NASA millions of dollars. He got it down to an equation that said for every pound that a woman weighed that was less than a man, how much did it end up saving NASA?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember the exact number, but it was a lot.
It was thousands of dollars, yeah. Mm-hmm. So thousands of dollars for every pound that a woman weighed less because they used less food, less oxygen, as you highlighted before. Now, how widely known were Randall Lovelace's experiments on women as potential astronauts?
At the time, not known at all, not well known at all. And he did that to sort of protect his theory while he was testing it. His goal was to be able to gather all of the data he needed to sort of present it to the powers that be and say, you know, argue with me now. Which, of course, they did, unfortunately.
Well, and it's interesting, too. I mean, for listeners who are listening to this, they should understand, how were Lovelace's experiments funded? Were they part of NASA or was it private funding?
No, it was private. It was part of the Lovelace Foundation, and it was also partially funded by Jackie Cochran, who was a very famous female aviator at the time and plays a very interesting role in this story.
All right, so these are private funds. Now, none of our government money was being used for this program. He was operating, if you will, outside of the government at the time and sort of laying low, as you said, so that he could gather his data. In what ways did his being somewhat underneath the radar impact the viability of women becoming astronauts?
Well, I mean, what it did was allow him to conduct as much of the testing as he could. I think if he had gone through the regular channels, he wouldn't have gotten anywhere. So I think he would have been stopped from the get-go. So it did allow him to gather the data that he needed, and some of it was done on government sites, like at Pensacola. So it allowed him to go a certain amount of the distance, but not the whole way.
Yeah. All right. Well, that makes sense. We're talking to Tanya Stone, everybody. Almost Astronauts is her book, 13 Women Who Dared to Dream. And the first of the 13 women is a woman by the name of Jerry Cobb. She was the first woman to complete the same NASA training performed by the other Mercury 7 astronauts. So tell us a little bit about Jerry Cobb.
Yes. So Jerry Cobb is sort of our heroine in this story. And Jerry Cobb was a very well-known, record-breaking female pilot at the time. And she met Randy Lovelace, who told her what he was planning. And, of course, she couldn't wait to volunteer for the job, so to speak. And so he started to put her through all of the physical fitness tests that the Mercury 7 men had gone through. And then she also went through all of the psychological testing. The interesting part about the psychological testing was that by the time they had finished with the Mercury 7 men, the scientists had sort of determined that the psychological testing they had put the guys through wasn't really up to snuff. They wanted to, and that's just the evolution of science. That has nothing to do with discrimination. So they looked at the psychological testing they had put the men through, and another scientist named Jay Shirley said, you know, I can make a better test than that. And he devised this water tank isolation test, which was much more difficult and much more harrying. And that was the test that Jerry Cobb went through. And then she also did some of the mastiff testing with some of the giant machinery that they had there for the astronauts to go through. So she went through three phases of testing. And then some of the other women started to come up behind her in terms of starting to go through the testing. And they went through not as much of the testing as Jerry had done, but all of the physical testing that the Mercury 7 men had been through.
Well, and give us the results of Jerry Cobb, because she was the one who finished the entire battery of tests. And as you pointed out, some of the tests were even harder than the men had gone through. What were the results of the findings after Jerry had gone through all of this?
Jerry's results were equal to or better than all of the men. So she did not do worse than any of the men on any test, and in some instances did better. She also had many more thousands of flying hours than several of the men.
That's true. She had more hours logged than John Glenn, who everybody knows not only as an astronaut but also as a U.S. senator, and
right.
Scott Carpenter on that. Well, now, tell us, what type of person is Jerry Cobb? Because you had a chance to interview her for the book and get to know her a little bit. What was she like, or is she like?
Jerry is a very quiet, private, respectful, sweet person. I actually spent a weekend with nine of them, and with Jerry, I sort of sat, you know, off to the side and kind of let her get to know me and sort of see what I was all about before I really started to ask her many questions. She sort of keeps to herself. She's a very sort of ethical and honest, kind of quietly brave person.
And because she is so quiet and because she is so ethical, she doesn't really speak ill of anybody, doesn't want to stir up any sort of controversy around that. But there was controversy that came out of that, including a private interview that she had with then Vice President Lyndon Baines Johnson. Tell us about that.
That's right. Well, this was sort of the smoking gun, so to speak, of the whole shebang. The meeting took place very soon after the women found out that they were not going to be allowed to be admitted to the space program. One of the other women of these 13 was a woman named Jane Hart, and her husband was a senator. And so she sort of knew the ins and outs of Washington. So she and Jane Hart and Jerry Cobb decided to, you know, sort of fight back against this verdict of not letting women into the space program. And Jane Hart was able to wrangle a private meeting with LBJ, who, as you said, was then the vice president, and he was also the liaison to NASA. So they, you know, they didn't mess around. They went straight to the top. And they had this meeting with him, during which time they discussed him supporting them and drafting a letter to James Webb, who was the head of NASA at the time. So the what happened in that meeting sort of remained a mystery for quite a long time, about 40 years, in fact, at which time a woman named Margaret Weidekamp, who is currently a curator at the National Air and Space Museum and who you may notice wrote the foreword to my book, she was doing research for her PhD thesis on this very story. And she was down doing research at the LBJ Library in Texas, and out she pulled a copy of this letter that he had supposedly sent to James Webb 40 years ago supporting the women. But instead of having sent the letter, he had scrawled across it in sort of dark black ink, "Let's stop this now!" exclamation point, wrote "file" on it, and had stuck it in a drawer. And so it had sat there, just hidden from the world for 40 years until this woman, Margaret Weidekamp, doing her research, had discovered it. So that was sort of, you know, number one evidence that kind of linked him to the controversy. And then in 2008, I think, that was when Jerry kind of finally, after many years of keeping quiet to herself, decided that it was time for her to say what had actually gone on in the office. And what she says happened is that Lyndon Johnson said that he could not support them because if he supported them, he would have to support all of the other minorities that were trying to get into the space program as well.
So much for the Great Society. That's an interesting story that you tell there. We're talking to Tanya Stone, author of the book Almost Astronauts, 13 Women Who Dared to Dream. Tanya, how long did it take before women were actually admitted into the NASA space program?
The first class of women and minorities were admitted at the same time. It was the class of 1978. That's the class that held Sally Ride.
1978. So it took basically 18 years before women were inducted into the NASA space program after
this.
That's
right.
All right, Tanya, and looking at it from your perspective as an author and somebody who writes children's books as well, what do you want readers to take away from reading Almost Astronauts?
Well, a couple of things. For one, I'm sort of always looking to kind of help fill in the blanks of our missing history. We have textbooks in our classrooms that have a lot of holes in them in general, and those holes generally have to do with women and minorities. So one of the things I'm often interested in doing are discovering little-known stories of episodes in American history to share with readers so that they learn more of the whole picture of our history going forward. The other is that sometimes it doesn't matter whether you get the win for yourself. Because some people sort of said to me when I was trying to write this book, well, why are you trying to write a book about something that didn't happen, or, you know, people who failed at doing something? And from my perspective, that's not it at all. What they did was really important, because what they did was pave the way for the people who came after them. And so it's sort of nice to kind of shine the light on people who fight the good fight and put themselves out there and take risks, whether or not they end up enjoying the win. at the end, because they are sort of moving history forward. And I always tell kids when I talk to groups of school kids that, you know, change doesn't happen overnight in any subject matter. It's always when there's something difficult that needs forward movement on. It's a collective effort. It's not maybe not one person, it's maybe not one group, and it's maybe not just one time of someone working towards something. So those are some of the reasons why I like these kinds of stories.
And they're very compelling reasons. It's a very compelling story. We've been talking to Tanya Stone, everybody, author of the book Almost Astronauts, 13 Women Who Dared to Dream. Tanya, if people like the sound of this story, they want to learn more about you, they want to learn more about your book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, the easiest place to learn about all of my books is at my website, which is simply www.tanyastone.com, which is T-A-N-Y-A-S-T-O-N-E. And they can also go to booksense.org, which is the national website link for all the independent bookstores, and, of course, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, those places.
And, of course, our own Bank of Books here in Ventura. Remember, Bank of Books can order any book that you want from any of the sources that are out there. Thank you, Tanya, so much for being our special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.